Syria's civil war erupted last week. It's a conflict that could change the Middle East, Europe, and the world. But it's also a conflict with a whole lot of different factions, and it's one that many people find confusing. Let's shed some light on it on today's Trumpet World. Now, September 2012, Trumpet Print Magazine, editor-in-chief Gerald Flowery wrote, "Right now, Bashar Assad's Syria is closely aligned with Iran. But this prophecy shows that these two nations are about to split. This will have a domino effect on other nations. These events will really shake this world and dramatically alter the course of history." We had the Syrian civil war. Here we are now, 12 years later, and we could be watching this happen before our eyes. What is going on in Syria? How do all of these events tie in with Bible prophecy? Well, my name is Richard Palmer, Assistant Managing Editor of thetrumpet.com. I'm joined by Mihailo Zekig, our main Middle East man, who's going to help us understand what is going on here. We want to break it down, make this as simple as possible. Last week on our Friday show, we kind of pretty quickly covered the latest developments from the Middle East, from Syria. But what is the big picture here? What is happening? So let's start with the main player, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Who is he? What's his background?
Well, he's been president of Syria, quote unquote, since 2000, more like a king at this point because he inherited from his father, Hafez al-Assad, who was leader of Syria since 1971 up until that time. He basically runs Syria through the apparatus of the Arab Socialist Ba'ath Party, which in layman's terms, basically started out as a socialist revolutionary party in Syria to get rid of foreign influence, to support Arab nationalism. But by this point, they basically don't have any ideological push to them anymore. It's just an instrument of control of the Assad regime. Bashar Assad took over, a lot of people were hoping he'd be a little bit more moderate than, say, his father. For decades, Syria has a reputation of being a main sponsor of terrorism around the world, even before jihadism and Islamism crept in, and to this day is one of the very few countries still on the U.S. state sponsor of terrorism. He was educated in the United Kingdom, originally to become an...
So the London School of Economics?
Actually, I believe it was to be an optometrist or something along those lines. That's actually where he met his wife. She's Syrian family, but British-born. And so a lot of people were hoping that he would moderate Syria when he came in, and to be fair, I don't think we've seen as much outside involvement of Syria's forces, of Syria's intelligence since he became president compared to his father. And there was even rumblings that he may have even been potentially able to make a peace deal with Israel well before the civil war, of course. But that obviously all came to an end in 2011. Since then, with the Arab Spring, with the Syrian civil war, events have spiraled out of control. He's used chemical weapons on his own people, and even without that, the response that the Syrian government has taken to rebels and protesters, civilians alike, has shown that he is very much an iron-fisted ruler. In some senses, because of his stockpiles of chemical weapons and his willingness to use them, you can almost consider him like the Arab world's North Korea. Is a bit of a pariah state, that he doesn't really have that many friends, even among some other authoritarian governments. But because of that, because of his precarious situation, he has needed to rely on a few other unsavory regimes, like North Korea, for example. There are North Korean troops in Syria training, and some other players, which we'll get to in a moment.
In some ways, standard Middle Eastern strongman, kind of think Saddam Hussein, Colonel Gaddafi, that kind of an individual, with the exception, I just checked, it was his wife that went to the London School of Economics. You look at his wife, British born, him, his education, people did think that he might be a more enlightened despot, say, which didn't happen. I think the other absolutely critical part of his background is that he's an Alawite. It's kind of a branch of Shia Islam. That's an oversimplification, but I think today is a day for oversimplifying things a bit, which provides him with a link to Iran that is the big Shia patron in the Middle East. There are differences. There are religious differences between the Alawites and Iranian Shia Islam, but that connection is important. And it also means it's not just about a political party. And like you say, that political party is kind of irrelevant. It's not about political ideology. But he is, say, a leader of a tribe, a leader of a faction within Syria.
Well, actually, that ties in pretty well with his political party in general, in the sense that it gives him a foot inside the Islamic world and a foot outside. Syria, like a lot of Arab states, going back to when they became independent, were basically carved on a map between the colonial powers, in this case, the French. And so there isn't really too much of a cohesion between their population. The Alawites, as you mentioned, they're an offshoot of Shia Islam, although most Muslims don't even consider them Muslim anymore. For example, they drink alcohol, which is normally very, very taboo in Islam. And Iran, for its part, has tried to make overtures to Syria. Originally, they became allies because they both were against Saddam Hussein's Iraq, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. The Shia connection happened to be a bit of an excuse to keep going with that, and Iran considers Alawites to be normal, or at least within the Shia sphere of influence for that reason, even though they disagree on so many different doctrines. But it's important to realize that Assad and his regime, yes, they've been sponsoring terrorism for decades. Yes, they have links to Iran and a bunch of other groups, but they themselves are not Islamist. Their, as I mentioned, their ideology was originally rooted in socialism. And if you could see it today, it's like, you know, women in Syria generally do not wear headscarves. Mrs. Assad does not have a headscarf on when she appears on television. Whenever Assad's visiting his allies, like the Iranians, like, say, Hezbollah, usually he'll be the only person in a suit and tie while everybody else around him is in black robes and turbans. So his government is very, very much a secular government, even if he has to make friends with some other religious fanatics.
Right. He's a Saddam Hussein or Colonel Gaddafi, yes, not an Ayatollah Khomeini.
Yes.
And this point that you made about Syria not being a cohesive state, like, this is critical. And maybe that's a bit jargony, cohesive state. Like, Lebanon is the classic example of this, where Britain and France come along about 100 years ago and draw lines on the map. And these lines on the map do not relate to there being long-standing communities that feel like they're all one whole and that they're part of one nation. Like, you know, look at Europe and you have France, where everyone speaks French. They all agree that they belong to the French nation. There's a lot of disagreement in French politics right now, but they all agree on that. And they all value that, no matter how much they might disagree, that this person is socialist and I'm a conservative, or this person's from from Provence and I live in Calais. They all agree that we have the fact that we're French in common, and that matters, and that's important. And because of that, we're willing to make some shared sacrifices, and we may argue and we may disagree, but this sense keeps those arguments and those disagreements in bounds. That is not the case. You know, Lebanon, the classic example, where for people it's much more important that they are Christian or they are Shiite Muslim or they belong to this tribe or this community than they are Lebanese. And the fact that they're Lebanese is almost something imposed upon them by outsiders that they don't care about. Syria, you know, the Bible talks about Syria if you're reading King James English. I think that maybe gives us this impression that it's more of an ancient, more of a well-founded state than it actually is, something like Egypt, when that's not really the case. And it's like many of these other countries in the Middle East, where you have a group of different tribes forced together by these borders on a map and held together by a strong man in power. And they've got nothing to do with each other. I mean, you saw this in Iraq, where you've got a divided country. They're all forced together by the fact that they have a strong man, Saddam Hussein, that's over them. You see this in Libya, where you have all of these different groups and they're forced together by the fact they have a strong man. The Alawites are a minority in Syria. They kind of dominate. They have all of the top jobs because they're in charge. And all the rest, not only do they not like the Alawites, they're not even all that keen potentially on being a part of Syria. There are a lot of other identities that are much more important to them than being Syrian. And again, Syria, the fact that they're Syrian is something that's imposed on them from outside. And even the Islamic State, like, we will get to them, but they were huge. I think everyone knows that they were huge with the Syrian civil war. Like, they're founded on an active rejection of that fact. And that is critical to remember to understand why people don't like Assad. He's a dictator, and very much viewed as a dictator from a rival tribe, a rival community. But also it explains why these different tribes disagree with each other so much. They are not necessarily fighting for a free Syria or even a unified vision of Syria or even a vision of Syria at all. They are fighting for factional interests, and they don't really care about the idea of Syria as a whole.
Well, the name Syria itself is a social construct. It goes back to the Seleucid Empire, one of the successors of Alexander the Great's empire way back when, which controlled everything from the Mediterranean to the border with India, including what used to be called Assyria. And that eventually got applied to the whole country. Eventually, the Seleucids lost all their territory but this little bit on the Mediterranean, but the name stuck, including when the Romans came. So when we talk about Syria, that's actually referencing Assyria, which isn't even the heartland. The Assyrian people that still live in the area and call themselves Assyrian, they're not even in Syria anymore. So it's even a fake name, you could say, of the area.
Yeah, like ancient historians won't talk about Syria. They'll talk about Aram or Aram Damascus or Aram Syria to try and make... But yeah, there is not an ancient Syria in the same way that there is an ancient Egypt that has a long history as a political community. So Assad... evil dictator, to keep things oversimplified, ruling over a country that's made up of a bunch of different factions that don't like each other and are forced together into a single state. He's been ruling since 2000. His father ruled before him. So seeming pretty stable, even though he's got a lot of people that don't like him. Why did the wheel start to come off for his regime?
Well, the critical year, as I mentioned earlier, was 2011. That was when a fruit vendor in Tunisia set himself on fire to protest a strong man there. And that got viral over the internet. You had a lot of people in a lot of different Arab countries see that and going, yes, we feel exactly what this guy's feeling. We're under the iron-fisted rule of some despot we don't like. Why do we have to put up with this? And this brought up protests and revolutionary movements everywhere from Libya, Egypt, the Persian Gulf, and Syria. A lot of these places that had these long-time ruling dictators. And for a lot of these places, like Egypt, the government folded pretty quickly. Libya, too, after outside pressure from places like the United States. Syria, Assad, they decided to crack down as much as possible. And he basically used his army to massacre a lot of those protests. And a lot of those people reorganized and said, well, if he's not going to budge, if he's not going to give us his freedom, we're going to take our freedom from him. And Syria spiraled out of control. And we look at Syria today, it's a small area, but it didn't take long for these different groups.
Okay. So Arab Spring breaks out. This gives rebel groups perhaps the most dangerous thing for from Assad's point of view that they could be given. And that is hope. They see all of these other countries toppling their strongmen. They think, we might do it. We could be next. That kicks off a rebellion among all of these different groups. Clearly lots of different factions. So who are some of the main different groups that want to get rid of Assad?
Well, one of the biggest ones back then and now is what used to be called the Al-Nusra Front. Today they go by the name Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, and that's what I'll be referring to them from now on, just to keep things simple. They are more or less an affiliate of Al-Qaeda, or at least that's how they started off, the same group that...
So keeping things, going back to like to the broader picture, one faction that wants to get rid of Assad is Sunni Muslims.
Sunni Muslims, yes.
Which, Sunni Muslims is quite, there'll be a wide spectrum of, say, extremism, of different positions here. So Islam, in general, is the big split in Islam is between Shiite Muslims and Sunni Muslims about who would be the successor to Muhammad. and a lot of other things go along with that, and the approach to succession, the approach even to the way government is handled and things like that. But that's the big disagreement. So there's a lot of Sunnis that do not like being ruled by Alawites. And like you said, they do not even consider the Alawites Muslim. So, and the most motivated of the Sunnis are going to be the most extreme. And those extremists will tend to be terrorist groups. And of course, we're looking at a range of different factions of terrorist groups, because a lot of these will split off from each other. But Sunni extremists would be one block that wants to get rid of Assad, and Al-Qaeda, and then offshoots of Al-Qaeda. So this was Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which then it became like Al-Qaeda in Al-Sham, which then became the Islamic State. These were groups that split off from Al-Qaeda, but they're Sunni terrorist groups that wanted to get rid of him. Now, Islamic State became massive. They grabbed the attention by being the most shocking, the most cruel in the Syrian civil war, at least in terms of terrorist attacks. There was a lot that was shocking and cruel coming from Bashar al-Assad as well, you know, gassing civilians. So they came out of it, and we've got these kind of... They're mostly old news in Syria. I think there's a lot in prisons. They're not a particularly major player in this latest outbreak of rebellion. The whole world was kind of outraged by Islamic State. They also became a convenient excuse for outside powers to get involved. We'll get into the outside powers in a minute. So they're mostly history, and we're looking at this new group, HTS, as the latest offshoot of Al-Qaeda. And they're a group that... They know that being an offshoot of Al-Qaeda is not great for branding, is not great for outside support. The leader's distanced himself publicly from Al-Qaeda. But of course, how much of that is PR and how much of that is genuine is something a lot of people are asking questions about.
Well, actually, I would say that they're not necessarily a new group. They were actually active at the same time, and probably while Assad was trying to mop up the Islamic State, and again, they were probably the most serious threat to his rule. Al-Nusra, or HTS, they were the ones putting up the pressure from the north as well. And like, as you said, that both are Sunni Islamist, both reject the legitimacy of Assad's state, but they have two very, very different approaches to how they, or their vision for the future. ISIS, or the Islamic State, they were basically, everybody that's not with us is an infidel. We side with nobody. We reject any opposition from anybody else. And that proved to be their undoing. And while HTS on their part, I think they learned a lot from that, in the sense that if we're going to topple Assad, if we're going to get anything done, we need to A, moderate our position, at least on the surface a bit, so B, we could get some outside backers. And it appears that's what they've been doing, and it looks like it's been pretty successful for them. And so for the last few years, there's been a ceasefire since 2020 in the civil war, which is why you look at maps today and they'll usually show the same groups in the same areas without much changing for the last few years. They've controlled Idlib province, including Idlib city, which is a northwestern corner, not quite on the Mediterranean coast, but just south of Turkey, just south of Antakya, the city there that famously got hit by an earthquake last year. They didn't really have much influence outside of there in Syria, but they've certainly been well-armed, and they've been able to hold onto this pocket for a while. And for longest time, Assad hasn't taken too many serious opportunities to get rid of them. Leading up to this attack, actually, there have been a few skirmishes from Assad's forces against them in minor positions, including some that killed, I believe it was a school or something like that, where a lot of children died at the hands of Assad, which some people think led up to why now. But for the most part, they've been able to hold their own.
So Sunni Muslims, various different factions beneath that, that's one group fighting to get rid of Assad. Who else is there?
Well, the main one, especially as regarding U.S. support is concerned, would be the Kurds. Now, these are, you hear a lot of different names being thrown around them on what they call themselves or who they're fighting, like the Syrian Democratic Army or Rojava. We'll call them again the Kurds just for their simplicity's sake. They are not Arab. They are Muslim. They are Sunni Muslim, but they identify first and foremost with being Kurdish. Their language is actually closer to Persian than it is to Arabic. It's not even a Semitic language. And this has basically been the, I guess you could say, the reoccurring flashpoint in this part of the Middle East for the better part of 100 years now. A little bit of a history lesson. You go back to World War I. Turks, the Ottoman Empire, controlled all this area. The British knew that to defeat the Turks, they needed to make friends with some of the people they were ruling over. And they promised the Kurdish people a state.
Kurdistan.
And that never happened.
Yeah, Winston Churchill was pretty cross that that never happened.
Mm-hmm. Instead, they carved up Kurdish territory into three different areas in Syria, in Iraq, and some got into Turkey as well. And there's Kurds that are living in Iran as well. So.
And if you look at the map, there is a Kurdistan. Like, that's the irony, is we're talking about fake political units and Syria not being a real country in the sense that nobody really wants to be Syrian. You could very easily put a Kurdistan on the map and have a population that all wants to be part of Kurdistan and would be willing to sacrifice for Kurdistan and would actually be a very pro-American country right in the middle of the Middle East. Like,
very pro-Israel country. Like, Israelis can visit Iraqi Kurdistan right now because the Kurds control the borders. If they tried to visit Iraq proper, that would never happen, but the Kurds do let them in.
The Kurds are like, they're always thrown under the bus. They're always so willing to help the United States. The United States has helped them a lot, too. The United States kind of saved them in some ways from Saddam Hussein. I mean, there were also plenty of times the United States has stood by and not done very much. But I was reading an article from a journalist years ago talking about traveling through Kurdistan. He talked about finding a McDonald's in northern Iraq. And he was like, well, this is weird. Like, I know there aren't any McDonald's in Iraq. And he goes over there and everything is just a little bit off. Like, it's the wrong font on the menu and it's not quite what it is. And it's like, well, this is weird again, because McDonald's, part of the whole point of McDonald's is it's standardized. You get a similar experience no matter where you go. And he realizes this is a fake McDonald's. This is the Kurds love America so much, want to be like America so much, that they're building their own McDonald's restaurant so they can be like America. And again, that gives you a great flavor for who some of these people are. Now, again, just like there's a whole broader a range of different spectrums within say Sunni Muslim, there's a range of different spectrums within the Kurds and even some that groups that might be, say, be more extremist than others and things like that. But in general, I think that gives you a good picture of who these people are. And they very much want, they would love to have their own state. And the big complicating factor here that we'll get to as we bring in the outside powers is if you set up a Kurdistan in Syria, well, they're going to want a chunk of Iraq to also be part of this Kurdistan. They're going to want a chunk of Turkey to also be part of this Kurdistan. They're potentially going to want a bit of Iran to be part of this Kurdistan. That means that every country that has a Kurdish minority vehemently opposes the creation of a Kurdish state and tends to oppose the Kurds in general. This is a big part of the reason why they did not get a Kurdish state after the toppling of Saddam Hussein. America needed Turkey's help to be involved in Iraq. If they'd set up a Kurdish state, they would lose help from Turkey. And so that's always the calculus. This is always why the Kurds always get thrown under the bus. So we've got Sunni Muslims, we've got the Kurds.
And to specify, they're also in the northwestern area too. They control a large area of territory. And for their most part, they're sort of content with the status quo because Assad leaves them alone because they can't really do much about it. But they're probably the second most organized military in the area after Assad himself.
And that's, you've got the Peshmerga, those mm-hmm. who seek death, mm-hmm. But then various other militant groups, rebel groups, some active in Turkey, some mm-hmm. active in Syria, that mm-hmm. are all kind of part of that Kurdish umbrella. Mm-hmm. So any other internal factions that it's worth us knowing about?
There is a small group of Syrians that are aligned with the United States that the U.S. is propping up in the very south. They're probably the closest we get to a group that actually wants a democratic Syria, and they're probably the group with the least power as well. And the only reason they exist is because the U.S. is occupying a bit of southern Syria. But because of that, it gives the U.S. an excuse to be there, which I think is a bit of a stabilizing factor. If America wasn't there, you'd be seeing a lot more massacres. The last group I'd mention is the Syrian National Army, which is not the army of the Syrian
yes,
government in Damascus,
that's a good point.
But it's what it claims to be the rightful opposition to Assad, but in practice is really a hodgepodge of different militias that really only have one thing in common. They're all sponsored by Turkey, and they're all concentrated along that northern border between Syria and Turkey. And there's a bit of overlap between what they control and what HTS controls. And as the recent events of last week going into now show, there is a bit of alignment between the two groups to one degree, in the sense that they both don't like Assad.
And they're both Sunni.
Yes.
They're both Sunni Muslims, but they kind of have different patrons and...
Well, again, it's a bit of a hodgepodge, so not all of them are necessarily Islamists. I think they're probably the best you could say, in the sense that they're what we used to see in the Arab world, like with strongmen and rogue generals like Khalifa Haftar in Libya or some of these other guys. They basically, they're following the guys with the power, they're following with the guys with the guns, and they basically want to be Assad without Assad.
And what are they fighting for? Are they fighting, like, Kurds are fighting for an independent Kurdish state. Mm-hmm. That would be what they would like. HTS and the more extreme Sunnis, some of those may be like ISIS was fighting to found an Islamic caliphate. Some within that block would be seeing this fight as part of a global jihad. You mentioned you've got a minority that are fighting to establish a free and democratic Syria. Like, if these Turkish-backed groups got their way, what would Syria look like?
It probably wouldn't look that much different than what Assad is doing right now, but it had different people at the top, not the Alawites, and it probably would be a lot less heavy-handed in the sense of, again, like being willing to use chemical weapons on their own people, getting Hezbollah and some of these Iranian groups involved, and crucially, and this is especially why Turkey's interested in them, they are probably the biggest opponents to Kurdish independence, which is why whenever anything happens with Turkey and the Kurds, they often use these groups to go after the Kurds.
So if, I guess I don't want to get too much into the outside powers quite yet, but if these guys took over, would Syria be a Turkish puppet state, or is that overstating their ties to Turkey?
They basically don't have any other foreign backers, and I highly doubt, at the very least, if the dust were to settle, the international community would be that quick to start sponsoring them. And they, for their part, the Syrian National Army, would know the hand that feeds them. So you could very well call them a Turkish puppet state. We're already... I don't know why I keep coming back to Libya in this, but in Libya right now, the internationally recognized government is, for all intents and purposes, a Turkish proxy, and that Turkey would probably want something similar to happen with these guys.
I mean, I do think Libya is a helpful one to come back to, because it is just such a similar thing, where you have a country of different peoples with very different goals and ideas. Libya split between East and West, held together with a strong man. You shoot the strong man, and everything falls apart. Or in Syria's case, the strong man weakens. But I think you can already see why some of this gets confusing, because, say, the Kurds and the Turkish-backed groups, in many ways, are allies. Like, they want their opponents of Assad. That puts them on the same side. But then in this other way about Kurdish independence, Kurdish state, are complete enemies. And that steps up times 10 when you start to bring in international powers.
And it also doesn't help that all of these groups want to show that they're the legitimate government of Syria. So they all call themselves the Syrian National Army or the Syrian Democratic Forces or whatever, and it's easy to get lost in some of these names. But as you said, with the international powers, Syria obviously is in a very, very strategic location. It basically connects the rest of the Middle East with Turkey going into Europe. It has ports on the Mediterranean Sea. It has connections with the Euphrates River that flows into Iraq. And with the Islamic State, with the flourishing of there, and their idea of we're having no friends and we're going to expand really fast. That gave, as you said, a lot of countries an excuse to come into Syria and put countries down. From Assad's perspective...
Right, yeah, let's start with him. Who wants to keep him in power?
Well, one of the most important ones would be Iran. They, again, ideologically, they don't actually have that many things in common with the Syrian government. Like, it is very much a secular government in Syria, which normally is what Iran's trying to overthrow. But in this case, you had Saddam Hussein going back decades that made both mad. They thought the enemy and my enemy is my friend, and they came together that way. And since then, when the Islamic State really pushed its boundaries, when Syria realized they didn't really have many people that could come and defend them, then they called on Big Brother in Tehran to come in and liberate them, which is why you have such a huge presence of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps in Iran, which is why Syrian officials and Iranian officials constantly make back and forth trips to visit each other, which is why Iran is one of the few countries still willing to do business in Syria.
So the Syrian Civil War ended up actually increasing Iran's influence, presence on the ground in Syria, because Assad couldn't really stand on his own two feet. He really needed those Iranian backers.
Very much. And not only Iran, but of course, once you get Iran on your side, that means you get all of Iran's proxies on your side too. And in Syria's case, that meant bringing Hezbollah and Lebanon in. Obviously, Hezbollah's in the news quite a bit lately, and Hezbollah's number one enemy is Israel. But you go back 10 years, and they were actually doing more fighting, you could say, in Syria on behalf of Assad's forces, and they actually were even against Israel. So, and they're one of the reasons a lot of people see in the public mind that Assad was able to stay in power, which again furthers the Sunni-Shia divide within Iran. I mean, and within Syria. Another big player, arguably Syria's most important backer, would be Russia.
Which is, this comes a little bit from left field. Like, okay, the Iranian connection, yeah, they're different. That makes a bit of sense. Though Russia comes in, why do they care?
Well, you have to remember, Assad, on paper at least, runs a socialist government, and they had their socialist revolution in the Cold War. And who's the big backer of socialism in the Cold War? The Soviet Union.
Who was making all kinds of links with a lot of different Middle Eastern groups, especially pan-Arab groups. So, yeah, that makes sense historically.
Mm-hmm. And to the point where even Russia's only naval base in the Mediterranean Sea, Tartus, which gets a lot of coverage about what's Russia going to do with that, that goes all the way back to Soviet times. So that's a long-standing relationship with them since, obviously, communism's collapsed, but Russia still kept links with... I mean, that hasn't stopped them with being friends with Cuba, for example. And for Syria's case, interestingly enough, at least before the civil war with refugees and all of that, who knows what's like now, but there were over 2 million Christians living within Syria, mostly belonging to what would call itself the Patriarchate of Antioch, but it's really the Syrian Orthodox Church, which has huge links with the Russian Orthodox Church. And so there's even a religious connection with Syria and Russia that way. And Assad, for his point, he knows that if he does anything good to the Orthodox Christians, that's going to make Russia happy. So, like the Alawites, they've also been a very favored minority within Syria, to the point where the Syrian patriarch is more or less a mouthpiece for the government, as the Russian patriarch is in Russian society.
Huh. I didn't know that that religious link, actually. But that's important. Then this naval base is crucial. Like, for Russia... Russia's naval position is really bad. Like, they really, really want a warm water port. They have ports on the Black Sea. They've taken Crimea. But to get anywhere else in the world, they've got to sail through the Bosphorus. They've got to sail through these series of sea gates that Turkey controls and that Turkey can very easily shut to Russian shipping in times of emergency. And Turkey is a part of NATO. Another place for Russia to have a fleet would be in the Baltic, which, a long way from the Mediterranean, and Germany, Denmark, Sweden, like all of these NATO members, again, there's narrow straits that they can close.
And it freezes over in the winter. Like, Russia needs icebreakers to free up St. Petersburg every winter.
And then you have Murmansk, where that problem is times 10, where that freezes over. And this has been a perennial problem for Russia. I think the classic example of this is the Russo-Japanese War of around 1905, where Russia goes to war with Japan. They have to sail their navy all the way in, I think it was from Murmansk, all the way around the world. They're denied use of the Suez Canal. They've got to go around Africa. When they finally show up in Russia, they get sunk almost immediately because they're so exhausted from this long journey. Like, Russia really needs naval bases. Having a naval base in the Mediterranean is massive for Russia. And so that's something that they, in the past, have been willing to fight pretty hard to maintain. I think also they've enjoyed being a power player in the Middle East. And I think that's another, like, it did boost Russian prestige and reputation on the world by backing Assad.
They also get a lot of raw materials, like, by getting links with some of these warlords. That's why Russia is in Africa, for example, to get gold and oil. Syria is not necessarily that plentiful on that, but it is a gateway to some of these other places.
Yeah, great point. So these are Assad's two main backers, Iran with Hezbollah and Russia, and this explains why the conflict exploded last week. Because both of these backers are under a lot of pressure and are really distracted right now. You've got Iran is mostly focused now on fighting Israel. Hezbollah has been a massive Iranian tool for propping up Assad. Hezbollah are being, you know, kneecapped, at least decapitated, maybe a better term, by Israel. That really limits how much they can help in Syria. And then Russia, meanwhile, is focused on the war in Ukraine. And yeah, we could have a whole show kind of trying to work out, are they winning? Are they losing? How? There is no denying that it is consuming huge amounts of Russian resources. They do not have the same kind of spare resources that they had 8 years ago to try and prop up Assad in Syria.
I mentioned last week, the very day that this offensive started by HTS on the on Aleppo was the day the ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah went into play. And for their part, Israeli media has cited anonymous rebel sources in Syria saying, we were very, very happy that Israel was doing this to the point that people were accusing us of siding with you guys. And Hezbollah, for its part, Iran has been done a bit of scrambling to try and help Assad. The IRGC is coming in. Some Iranian militias in Iraq are coming in. Hezbollah has said they're going to sit this one out, which, again, they were a bit of a game changer 10 years ago. And now that this game changer is not coming in is a very big sign. For Russia's part, I mean, Aleppo, I think Russia besieged Aleppo for something like 4 years or something like that, just to bring it back under Assad's thumb. And it took the rebels, 3 days to take it this time. That general that was in charge of taking Aleppo, Surikivin, nicknamed General Armageddon for what he turned Aleppo, he was one of the guys involved in the Wagner mutiny, and he's basically out of the picture right now.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, Russia's just lost a lot of the people. Mm-hmm. Whether for mutiny, Ukraine taking them out, but a lot of that senior command that was involved last time are gone now.
Exactly. A lot of them are sent over to Ukraine. And the other big thing that, I guess, filters in from all these conflicts is that, again, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So there's even reports that HTS, even though they have links with Al-Qaeda, they've actually had training from the Ukrainian special forces, per military sources cited from the Kyiv Post. And you do see this with some of how they approached the conflict. There was a huge emphasis that they used on drones on attacking Aleppo, including suicide drones. Where have we seen that playing out for the past 3 years? The big battlefield has been Kyiv. And so there may very well be some credence to those rumors.
And I think, you know, that brings us to some of their other backers. I think that definitely also brings up Turkey, where, I mean, Turkey has become this big regional drone power. Like, you know, Azerbaijan had their stunning success in the war with Armenia, largely due to their use of drones, largely which they got from Turkey. Ukraine has been kind of buying Turkish drones. Now Turkey, I guess, is probably helping some of these powers. So in terms of outside powers that want to get rid of Assad, Turkey would be quite high on that list.
Turkey would be the number one player on that list. Not necessarily because he wants, you know, democracy to flourish, etc., etc. President Erdogan there has his own interests at play. But in regards of anti-Assad forces that have the capability of doing the most damage and achieving the most, Turkey would definitely be, at this point in time at least, on the number one spot. And you could see that with how events played out. I mentioned it on the show last week. The main force on going into Aleppo, and just for a little update since we've done this show, the rebels have captured all of Aleppo and now are moving further south to a bit more of the Syrian heartland, which is, again, why Syria and some of its allies are scrambling now to contain the damage. But it wasn't just HTS that did this capture. It was also members of the Syrian National Army. And there were rumors that Turkey wanted to get them to stand down, perhaps not to shake up the status quo, but there's also been reports that this offensive has been being planned for over a year, and there's no way Turkey did not hear about it. And the very fact, at least, that they've been able to make sure it kept quiet shows that they've been giving their tacit support to the National Army, but also to HTS, which, again, has a border with Turkey and has Turkish troops nearby, and, again, is using these same kind of tactics that Turkey's pretty famous for. And, of course, Turkey has plenty of their own soldiers on military bases in the soil, in the area as well. Why are they doing this? Well, again, the Kurdish link is a big part of the puzzle, but Assad doesn't like the Kurds either. Why is he going after Assad? Well, interestingly enough, for the past years now, I think, Turkey has been trying to normalize relations with Assad. They've been throwing olive branches, saying, look, the Russians can be our mediators, etc., etc. And Assad's basically always thrown that out the window. He said, well, get rid of your troops first, then we'll talk. And now Turkey's saying, well, we're not getting rid of our troops. We're going to be doing some damage to you, and there's nothing you can do about it right now. Some people, analysts, are wondering that this may actually be Erdogan's method of tightening the screws, putting more leverage on Assad, like saying, look, we can do a lot more harm to you than we can. You need us. You better start talking now. Whether that's the case, or whether it may very well be that perhaps some of these rebel groups are getting a little bit agitated, even with normalization, like, you know, you're sponsoring us and now you're going to leave us out to dry. Maybe they're bucking a little bit, and Turkey, for its part, is trying to do a bit of damage control. We don't know, but either way, Turkey is probably the most influential power player in this offensive in Syria right now.
So I'd like to talk a little bit more about Turkey's endgame, maybe in just a minute. Before then, I wanted to also bring in the Gulf Arabs. So the Organization of Arab States, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, in general, a lot of these groups also want to get rid of Assad.
Well, yes.
Well, this is what I want. Like, they historically have sided with the rebels, but for them, it seems like it's much more about, actually, we don't really care about Assad either way either much, but Iran is our enemy and we want to hurt Iran. And so for them, they were backing the rebels and they were kind of calling for Assad to go 10 years ago. But certainly since then, they have also kind of been like, hey, Assad, if you are willing to break with Iran, we're also quite happy to back you.
And they obviously have a lot of money to give to Assad to do that. And we've seen a lot of outreaches leading up to what's going on now in this vein, like, for example, Syria being readmitted to the Arab League, which Iran, of course, is not a part of because they're not Arab. The Gulf states, for the most part, they've been pretty relatively quiet at this point.
For both Turkey and then maybe a lesser extent the Gulf Arab states, so for Turkey's point of view, it seems to me they have a number of possible good outcomes for them. They could just de facto take a bunch of territory near the Turkish border, and that's kind of where they were already. They basically had, they hadn't officially moved the borders on the map, but they controlled a lot of border areas, which was very helpful for them in fighting the Kurds and gives them more kind of influence into Syria. Mm-hmm. That's a good outcome for them. Turning Syria into a puppet state and having their clients overthrow all of Syria, that's a good outcome for them. Or just having Bashar al-Assad break with Iran and letting them become the new kind of Middle Eastern patron, that's a good outcome for them.
And there's one more thing too, a bit of a wrinkle with this. The Syrian civil war, when it was flaring up, obviously sent a lot of refugees up. The ones that went to Europe probably got the most famous, or became the most famous of those, but Turkey by far taken the most.
They were paid by Europe to look after them.
Close to 5 million last
time. Yeah, the refugee angle is going to be huge, and we'll look at Europe's interest there, but Turkey certainly has a similar interest
Turkey's already sending some back now, even with everything going on right now. Not 5 million, but you could see what they're thinking.
Absolutely. Okay, well, let's bring in the United States as well. So the United States has been wanted to get rid of Bashar al-Assad because he's been gassing his own people. Like, that's the accusation that gets thrown out, and that will be pushed back on by Russia and generally Russian funded mouthpieces saying this is propaganda, this didn't happen. How sure are we that Assad has used poison gas and weapons of mass destruction against his own people.
Well, I mean, aside from all the videos circulating on the internet of people filming their own family spasming on the floor after a sarin gas attack, and Assad for himself claiming to send out all of his chemical weapons immediately after that in a public deal, which most likely has never actually been fully confirmed. Obviously, there's been no actual investigation on the ground to expose the plans or whatever, but it's fairly well documented.
Okay, so let's take that as a given. He has been using poison gas. America opposes Assad because of, say, ideological reasons. He's a dictator. We stand for democracy. He's poisoning his own people. You know, often, there's also an interest factor, too. Often just an ideological, we don't like this guy, is not enough to get the United States or any country really to commit troops. There's the, well, we want to reduce Iranian influence. We don't want Iranian terrorists having access to the Mediterranean Sea. Syria is a massive asset to Iran. There's also the geopolitical competition with Russia. Get rid of this Russian ally. If we can get rid of this Russian naval base, there's a major setback for Russia. Are there any more reasons for the United States to be involved?
Well, it depends on which administration's in power, and the fact that we're switching from a Democrat to a Republican one could mean a lot. The Kurds, for their part, as you mentioned.
Right. Kurds are U.S. allies. Yeah, that's a good point.
The U.S. The U.S. does have bases in there, but it's more of like support and logistics rather than actual fighting, say, with the group on Syria's southern flank. But also, if you're going to be spreading democracy, et cetera, if you want like something to just stabilize in there, the U.S. has been a bit of a stabilizing factor. And the fact that we haven't actually seen much fighting on that southern flank, which happens to have the U.S. supported troops, or even in the Kurdish heartland where there are more troops from the United States there, I think that says a lot. And regardless whether it's Democrats or Republicans in charge, you know, taking aside, you know, maybe what certain personalities might want to have done, most people across the spectrum want just to see the situation stabilized and for their part not have anything happen like with ISIS that warrants to one degree or another more American troops, more boots on the ground, more boys flying out of California and Kansas to be sucked into another Middle Eastern conflict.
Yeah, that I think is, I'm glad you brought that up. I think that's another important point. Like, especially in the post 9/11 world, this is diminishing a bit now, but the United States really wanted to make sure there weren't ungoverned spaces on the map that would allow terrorist groups to take root. And you see where you, like somewhere like Mali, that has their own kind of civil war, you can see how terrorist groups can really spring up, take advantage of that. They don't want terrorist bases in Syria. And this is what then kind of makes things complicated, because the one reason to try and stabilize Syria is to make sure you don't have terrorists. America has generally decided, well, we want to stabilize Syria by getting rid of Assad. The other people that want to get rid of Assad, some of them are terrorists. And this is where you have this weird dynamic where you had Sunni terrorists linked to Al-Qaeda trying to take over Iraq about 10 years ago or so, and America actually ended up fighting alongside Iran to try and get rid of those Sunni terrorists. Then you go to Syria, and America finds itself on the same side as the Sunni terrorists, and even on the same side as Al-Qaeda fighting against Iran. And this makes it, I think, genuinely a tough situation, where it is easy to say, okay, Assad is evil, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, so, okay, we don't like all of the rebels, we'll hold our noses, we'll fund them, we'll help them, we'll try and get rid of Assad. Trouble is, we've seen this movie before. Like when Russia invaded Afghanistan, America said, okay, the enemy is my friend, Russia is the evil empire, we will fund these Islamists on the ground. The
Taliban.
Right, those Islamists became the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and used the experience and even some of the weapons and the funding that they'd got from the United States to become American enemies. So it is a complicated situation for America and Syria. And there is this idea of, okay, well, we'll fund this tiny group that wants a free and democratic Syria. That they're a tiny group. They're kind of an irrelevance. Their only power is the fact that America feels comfortable giving them money, and really it does feel like any money that gives them is kind of just going to be helping Al-Qaeda, at least in terms of helping an ally of Al-Qaeda and changing the situation on the ground in their favor. So that's America's predicament.
Indeed. And there's one other country in the West that we have to bring in. We don't see their troops on the ground, but of course that would be Israel. Their main agenda is to stop Iran from using Syria to fund Hezbollah. And with Hezbollah decimated, with everything going on right now. And for its part, like, Israel is more than perfectly happy to see Iran and its groups get bogged down with some of these other problems. But they're actually, interestingly enough, tied in a bit more in the motivation with the Gulf states, in the sense that for the past few years, you've seen a lot of Israeli strikes on Iranian facilities within Syria, but they'll leave Russian ones alone. And they'll leave the Syrian army alone in as much as they're not actually with the Iranians, to the point where they'll even phone call Moscow and tell them, like, just to let you know, we're going to attack this little Iranian base right here to give the Russians a bit of a time to get out of the way. And so they don't really care what happens as long as Iran leaves. And so if, however, the dominoes fall, they may actually end up, like, again, because Al-Qaeda is saying these positive things about Israel. I don't think anybody in Israel trusts that Al-Qaeda has their best interests in at heart. So they may very well be waiting just to see who makes the better offer, like they're doing in Sudan Civil War. And whoever they could trust the most, they might back them. And that might be HTS. That might be the Assad regime, if they can offer enough bonuses toward that. But considering how much damage Israel's already done to Hezbollah, which is indirectly, at least, impacting this latest round of fighting, you can be sure they are a huge factor in the region that everybody has their mind on.
And this is the dynamic we saw earlier this year, where these Iranian bases are constantly getting attacked. It seemed like Assad was starting to think, well, maybe Iran is more of a liability than a help. Israel keeps striking Iranian bases. I risk getting drawn into this war with Israel. There were reports that he told his brother, who's a major army commander, you know, don't shelter Hezbollah. We're not taking sides. Don't transport troops or logistics for them. We want to stay absolutely out of this. He'd made overtures to Gulf Arab states. And it seemed like he might be trying to break with Iran just by himself. And the other component of this is there's been a massive economic toll of the Syrian civil war. Like, cities flattened, and then that takes a lot of cash, a lot of money to rebuild. And Iran has money for terrorist groups. Iran rebuilding Syrian cities and the Syrian economy is not a major priority for Iran, especially as Syria could turn around and then ally with someone else or go off somewhere else.
They won't even invest in their own economy. Why would they invest in the neighbors?
Yeah, a good point. And then Russia has been cut off from the rest of the world by US sanctions. Like, those sanctions have not had the devastating impact that we were told that they would. But still, they are not flushed with cash to go spending on building up other countries and things like that. The powers that do have cash that he could potentially turn to would be the Gulf Arab states that have all of their oil money. But this, I think, is when we bring in another Western power that is absolutely critical, and that is Europe, and that is most particularly Germany, where they have an interest even in investing in Syria's economy, and they have the cash to be able to do it. Because you have all of, you mentioned all of these refugees in Turkey, then there are of course all of these refugees in Europe and in Germany. They do not want another wave of refugees coming from another wave of war fighting, but they'd also love to be able to send their Syrian refugees back and potentially, like, there's potentially helping rebuild facilities and cities and the economy to send them back to. But then also, you would then have an influx of refugees that have spent the last 5 years living in Germany and are therefore now dramatically more wealthy than those in Syria. That could then bring a whole chunk of cash back with them into Syria. There's a lot of reasons for Europe to get involved. And so because of that, earlier in the year, it looked even like Assad might break with Iran, maybe retain the Russian link, and try and court the Gulf Arabs and Europe.
Indeed. And for its, maybe this is a little bit too much of the realm of speculation, but if these people have been living in Germany for so long, they have connections there. Many of them probably still speak German. Like, in a set, those links do not disappear when they go over home. In World War II, it was said that at least one, every Sicilian family had at least one person that immigrated to New York City. And when the Americans came in, they actually welcomed them as like family coming home and made the Allied invasion of Italy a lot easier. With, I mean, no matter how the dust settles with this current skirmish, the Middle East is still going to be a very important part of the world. The Levant, the particular place of Syria is in, still going to be important. And if Germany has all of a sudden hundreds of thousands of people that speak German, that have business connections in Germany, that's going to give them a huge leverage of influence.
And I think this is where our coverage now diverges from what you would see from a whole lot of other news outlets. I think almost this discussion of trying to break down what is happening in Syria, you could see that on the Wall Street Journal or some of these some other YouTube channels, and maybe they do a better job even than we've done of trying to break this down and keep it simple. They're not going to talk about Germany in this way, and it's because our focus on Germany getting involved in this region is based off of Bible prophecy. Now, again, there are logical reasons from world news to expect that as well. But there are specific prophecies that say that Germany is going to play a key role in Syria. And this is just this summer. Mr. Flurry had an article, Iran is losing Syria to Germany. And you know, he said Iran is about to lose its influence over Syria and as a result over the whole region. This will dramatically change events around Jerusalem. He talked about many nations oppose Iran. Syria has been an ally. Through it, Iran gained critical access to the Mediterranean Sea and a base to supply its terrorist proxies and to attack Israel. For years, Syria has played a crucial role in Iran's dominant presence in the Middle East. But Bible prophecy indicates that through Syria, Germany is about to get control of the Middle East instead. That's a unique focus. That is purely coming straight from Bible prophecy. One of the things that I just find absolutely fascinating is that even in this article, Mr. Flurry ties in the Syrian crisis and Syria's future with internal German politics. And he talks about Karl Theodor zu Gutenberg, this man we've been looking for as potentially being a German strongman, being very pro-German military intervention into Syria, and even talking about stabilizing the region, opening the door up to sending refugees back. This is another opportunity to see the Bible come to life on your nightly news. And it's happening at the same time that Germany is going through this political crisis and this election. And it may well be that that is not a coincidence, and that what is happening in Syria is going to tie in with what will happen with Germany politically. Now, I want to break down the Bible prophecy as simply as we have done what's going on in Syria, and we'll have another segment in just a moment where I'm going to take you through and show why we're watching for Syria to shift over to Germany. But before I do that, do you want to finish bringing us up to date on what is going on here and any other things you think we need to get into from the news, the history, to really understand what is going on in this critical part of the world?
Yes. The big response of this, I alluded to it several times, but this did catch Syria and Russia off guard. The very first day of the attack, we didn't cover this last week, but an elite Russian unit actually was killed by those rebels. And since taking Aleppo, the rebels have actually stormed the Iranian consulate there. And you can see pictures of them like throwing down pictures of Ayatollah Khomeini, example. And while the Syrian army, obviously they're regrouping, and they've been, and the Russian Air Force have been doing bombing campaigns in Idlib, the HTS has been taking the advantage and has been moving south towards through this highway system that basically connects almost all of Syria's major cities along one axis. And where they'll stop, who knows? They haven't reached any major population centers yet. But as long as they keep the momentum up, they do have a road going all the way to Damascus. So this is pretty serious for Assad. They're also making a push towards the Mediterranean Sea, probably first towards Latakia, which is before the civil war had about maybe 400,000, 500,000 people. But that's also, of course, where Russia's naval base is. So, which is, of course, Russia's big prize, as we've been talking about. So how far the rebels are able to push, you may very well see Russia and Syria start becoming more desperate and like and amp their response up a bit. But either way, when the first reports started coming out, Turkey or Turkish sources were telling media that this was supposed to be a limited operation, etc., to right a few wrongs that Assad violated after the ceasefire or whatever. Looks like the rebels are trying to go for broke here. And the leader of the rebels, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he, for his part, said way back when that Aleppo is the key to Damascus. And it looks like that is the strategy he is performing right now.
So everything to play for, still to come after, I guess, we've had, now we're into the second half of the Syrian civil war, potentially could be a very short half, I guess. But we could be seeing some dramatic changes. Well, thank you for helping us get to grips with this situation, Mihailo. We'll take a quick break and then I'll take you through some of what the Bible prophesies is coming next to Syria. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Trumpet World. We've been trying to shed some light on events in Syria on today's show. What is going on and why? The Trumpet's focus on Germany here is unique. Here's what Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry said on his Key of David program earlier in the year.
But Iran is losing Syria to Germany. It's happening even right now. They're losing them, and especially the people. And this is going to be a real shock to the world. You can be sure of that.
So why this focus on Germany? Well, I want to help you understand take you through some basic Bible prophecies that inform that. Because again, this is not a major focus you get from anywhere else. So as you watch what happens in Germany and watch what happens in Syria, you can watch this book come to life. So a key prophecy for understanding Iran and what is happening here and Germany and the Middle East is Daniel chapter 11. Now, Daniel chapter 11 is part of one long prophecy. Included in this prophecy is even Alexander the Great. He was forecast in the Bible before his time. It was prophesied that he would die young. It was prophesied what would happen after him. But in this part of Daniel chapter 11, we can note it says in verse 40, and at the time of the end. So even though there is some ancient history included in this prophecy that we can see this prophecy and your Bible has already been proven true, and you can read this passage and you can compare it with the history books. You can even go back and look at the history of Daniel and the book of Daniel itself and see why it could not have been written after Alexander the Great, why it had to have been written before then. You know, you can see and prove your Bible from this passage. There's also prophecy here for the time of the end. You see this confirmed in chapter 12 and verse 1, where it says, at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as there never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. So this is a time for the crisis at the close, for the end times. Daniel chapter 11 introduces us to two major powers that it focuses on, the king of the north and the king of the south. And we're introduced to these shortly after the death of Alexander the Great. And so this passage prophesied that Alexander the Great would die young and that his kingdom would be split in four. And one of these would become the king of the north, and that refers to the Seleucid kingdom in Syria. So there was a successor kingdom to Alexander the Great that ruled a lot of the Middle East from Syria. It's called the king of the north. And then the king of the south refers to the Ptolemaic kingdom in Egypt that dominated a lot of the area as well. So ancient history, king of the north dominating the Middle East from Syria, king of the south from Egypt. But when we get to verse 40, it says at the time of the end, and we're still talking about the king of the north and the king of the south. Who could they be at this point? I mean, the king of the Seleucid kingdom in Syria is long, long gone. Well, the Bible gives us the information that we need to work that out. One major clue is that in 65 BC, the Roman general Pompey the Great conquered the Seleucid kingdom of Syria, conquered the king of the north. So from this point on, the Roman Empire and that takes on its role of the king of the north. And other parts of Daniel and parts of the book of Revelation prophesy that this Roman Empire would continue in some fashion, that it would fall and others would come along and resurrect this. And sure enough, we see people resurrecting the Roman Empire, the Holy Roman Empire. You see Napoleons come along and market themselves as new Caesars and leading a new Roman Empire. So it's this European resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire that is King of the North. And we can also see this by putting Daniel chapter 11 alongside other Bible prophecies. You know, this is key. Mr. Armstrong talked about the Bible is like a jigsaw puzzle. The book of Isaiah says we have to go here a little, there a little. To get the full picture, we have to go to quite a few other passages. So if we look, for example, in staying with Daniel 11, we can see verse 41, it says, "He shall enter into the glorious land." So this king of the north, he comes and he conquers Israel. Verse 45 says, "He shall plant the tabernacle of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain." So this king of the north conquers the Jewish state of Israel in the Middle East, and it conquers Jerusalem. Well, we can look at other scriptural passages that tell us who does that. And those other passages identify this power as Assyria. And we've shown how this is modern day Germany. They also identify it as the beast power in the book of Revelation. This resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. So we can put these other scriptures side by side and gain more clarity that way. It's also worth noting, it mentions this king of the north coming in. He says he shall enter into the glorious lands. And the Hebrew there implies a peaceful entry, not a conquest. So he comes in peacefully, but it's a false peace. He comes in under false pretenses and then takes over. And you can see that somewhat from the passage here. You can see that, you know, earlier in the chapter, it talks about a type of this modern day leader, you know, coming in through treachery. Daniel chapter 8 talks about that as well, and a leader that uses peace to destroy many. And then there's other passages, for example, in the book of Ezekiel, that describe Assyria doing the same thing. Assyria conquered the northern tribes of Israel anciently, but Ezekiel was writing long after that happened. He's prophesying of another conquest. So we can put these side by side and see, well, all of this matches, that the king of the north refers to this European power led by Germany, this beast power that is Assyria in Bible prophecy. Well, who is the king of the south? Well, this passage itself allows us to eliminate a lot of possibilities. Egypt is mentioned separately. So it's not Egypt. The same with Libya, the same with Ethiopia. That gets rid of a great many, many possibilities. The Bible has a whole lot of prophecies about Edom. There's an entire book, the book of Obadiah, that talks about Edom, which is Turkey. And they're very different from what is prophesied for the king of the south. So it can't be Turkey. So we can check off a lot of these other powers. And very quickly, if we're looking at events revolving around the Middle East and revolving around Israel, there aren't a whole lot of alternatives left, but radical Islam led by Iran. And you see that in this focus in Jerusalem, in this passage. This is a conflict that revolves around the glorious land, the land of Judea. And it revolves around Jerusalem. Who else is there in the Middle East that is to the south of the king of the north, that is not one of these other powers, that is focused on conquering Jerusalem? Very quickly, we can narrow that down to Iran and radical Islam. So those are these major powers in this conflict. How does Syria play in? Well, for that, we need to introduce another passage, and that is in Psalm 83. Psalm 83 has been called a mysterious alliance. It prophesies of a group of nations that attacks, is prophesied to attack Israel, but there's no record of this happening in history. What is this talking about? Well, it's not mentioned in history because this is prophecy. It has to be Bible prophecy. It hasn't happened in history. And you can even see that there's some more hints within this passage that this is prophetic. Verse 3, for example, talks about them taking crafty counsels and consulted against your hidden ones. You know, there's a secrecy to this. There's a crafty counsels could be translated conspired against. You know, in the same way that the king of the north in Daniel chapter 11 enters the Holy Land under false pretenses. Well, there's crafty counsels. This is an alliance that comes in under false pretenses. And then this ties into a whole host of other passages. We can see also, if we jump ahead to the end of this alliance, Assyria is mentioned as well. In verse 8, it says, Asher also is joined with them. So this includes the king of the north, Germany. Asher, Assyria in prophetic language, is joined with this alliance. So this fits in perfectly with what is prophesied in Daniel chapter 11. And even you can look at the countries that are mentioned here in Psalm 83. None of the countries in Daniel 11 mentioned as being allied with the king of the south are mentioned in this alliance. These are two separate alliances facing off. And Daniel chapter 11 tells us, well, you have the king of the south, and then when the king of the north takes out the king of the south, he also takes out Egypt and Libya and Ethiopia. And the implication is that you have the king of the south, and allied to the king of the south is Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia. And so none of those nations are mentioned in Psalm 83. These fit hand in glove. You have a Psalm 83 alliance led by Germany, and they have regional partners in the Middle East, and they face off against the king of the south, against radical Islam led by Iran, and they have powers that are aligned with them. So these two prophecies fit together perfectly. Verse 5 again says, they have consulted together with one consent. They're confederate against you. It's a bit of a conspiracy. They're working together secretly to take out Israel in the Middle East. And there's more to it than just Israel in the Middle East as well. But I just want to focus today on, well, how does Syria tie into this? So verse 6 starts to list these allies for us. It says the tabernacle of Edom, the Ishmaelites of Moab, and the Hagarenes. So there's lots of different groups here that we could get into. Edom, I mentioned already. Well, that is Turkey. The Ishmaelites, the Arabs themselves claim to be descended from Ishmael, another son of Abraham. So you've got the Turks, you've got the Arabs, you've got that kind of anti-Iranian coalition that we can see already present within the Middle East. And then it says, and the Hagarenes. And Hagarenes just means descendants of Hagar, Hagar being the mother of Ishmael, this other woman that Abraham and Sarah brought into their marriage so that they could have a child. So in some ways, well, Hagar, the mother of Ishmael, Hagarenes, Ishmaelites, that's kind of the same thing, isn't it? Descendants of Ishmael, well, the descendants of Hagar are also descendants of Ishmael. We could look quickly at 1 Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 9 and 10. And here that mentions, it's telling us where various descendants of Reuben lived. And then verse 10, in the days of Saul, they made war with the Hagarites. So they were fighting these groups, the Hagarites. I mean, that's basically the same meaning as Hagarenes, the descendants of Hagar. And these are it's describing people living in northeastern Israel, kind of the Golan Heights area in modern political language, and around the east of the Sea of Galilee. You know, they're the ones that are butting up against the Hagarites. So these Hagarites, anciently, they're a branch of Arabs, a branch of the descendants of Ishmael that lived in what is modern Syria today. For whatever reason, that name of Hagar stuck with them. And we see this in later history as well. So when Assyria was in this area, they record a tribe that they called the Hagaranu living in this area that is now Syria. Again, Hagaranu, the descendants of Hagar. So there's this group of Arabs that have the name Hagar kind of stamped on them that have lived around that area of Syria over quite a long period of time. They were there in the time of Saul, in the time of Assyria, hundreds of years later. That's the region of the world that this is talking about. And so it's because of that mention of the Hagarites in Psalm chapter 83 that we're expecting Syria to be allied with Germany. And Psalm 83 has been a guiding prophecy for so much of what we've been seeing in the Middle East recently. I mean, if you look, the next verse talks about Gabel, and then further on it says Tyre. Gabel and Tyre, these are two Phoenician cities. Gabel is better known as Byblos. Both of these cities are in what is now today Lebanon. This is why Mr. Flurry said, well, watch for Lebanon to break with Iran and Hezbollah's power in Lebanon to be broken, because they're going to be aligned with Europe and with Germany and not with Iran. The same where it says the Philistines. I mean, if you look at where the Philistines lived anciently, it's in Gaza. And so Mr. Flurry said, well, ultimately Gaza is going to end up siding with this European power. So we're watching Psalm 83 play out before our eyes. And even we've seen in history examples of this kind of trend. And when Germany was getting more involved in the Middle East in World War I, they looked for regional partners they could work with. They drew very close to Turkey. Turkey was part of the German alliance in World War One, and they tried to use Turkey to reach out beyond to various other Arab states. In World War II, they worked most famously with the Mufti of Jerusalem to try and reach out to other Muslims that they could use to fight against Britain in that case. So there is historical precedent and examples of where we've seen this kind of thing happen before, though it's not precisely a fulfillment of the Psalm 83 alliance. Now, these two passages, Psalm 83, Daniel chapter 11, continue just to tie perfectly together. Daniel 11 describes the king of the north attacking the king of the south like a whirlwind, and you zoom in on what that Hebrew word means, and there's an element of terror and ferocity, and it shows you how terrifying that attack is going to be. But it also, just like a whirlwind kind of whirls around, there's an element of surrounding, of attacking from all sides. And so based on that word alone, well, you know that then that the king of the north has regional allies, regional bases, so that it can attack radical Islam from all sides, so that it can come against these various different pockets of radical Islam from all directions. And Psalm 83 then explains more about that and how that happens and tells us, well, these are the specific allies that they have. These were written hundreds of years apart, yet these two prophecies tie together perfectly and give us this perfect picture of what is happening in the end time in the Middle East. Now, this is just the briefest summary. We have a free book, The King of the South, that will take you through this in more detail and help you prove this to yourself. And this is written for, say, a complete beginner in Bible prophecy. We're not expecting you to have a massive understanding of the Middle East or of the Bible to be able to understand this book, The King of the South. It's easily digestible, and it will help you understand all of these forecasts. And these forecasts are going to go on to really change your world. Syria switching away from Iran and towards Europe, that is a massive milestone in Bible prophecy. It will be a massive milestone in world events. It's going to lead to Europe getting more involved in the Middle East. As Mr. Flurry even indicated in his article earlier in the year, maybe it will even play a role in a strongman rising up in Europe and in Germany as Europe tries to deal with its radical Islam problems, its mass migration problems, as it worries about another wave of migrants coming in from Syria. This could be huge in the German election. This could be like this. You've got the Alternative for Deutschland party that talks a lot about migration in Germany. And really, for people concerned about migration in Germany, which very valid concerns there, there aren't many other groups in many other parties people can turn to. And so this is going to weigh massively on the mind of German leaders. Could this swing the election? Could this change the election? Could this lead to another 5-10% boost in support for the Alternative for Deutschland? Well, if it does, that's going to make coalition formation much, much more difficult. And that's going to be a much bigger revolution for German politics. So, well, there's some strong incentive to try and deal with Syria and stop this spiraling out of control. France has played quite an active role in trying to get involved in Lebanon. Are they going to, as the former colonial power, get more involved here? There are a lot of ways that this could change your world. That's why you need this King of the South booklet, or book, I guess it is now, to understand what is happening here. And much more than that, it will help you understand the Bible. It will bring these prophecies from the Bible to life. And again, there's so many practical benefits that come from doing that. It really elevates the Bible and its power in your mind. You know, it shows that the Bible is a powerful book for right now that tells you what is happening in world events. Well, that really then elevates the importance of your own Bible study. And that as you read this book, you're knowing the power of every single word here. And it will help you dig in and apply every single word to your life, to your problems, to seeing solutions in your life. And I'll just conclude with one more scripture from this same Daniel 11 prophecy, you could say. It's actually from Daniel chapter 12, but it's the same prophecy here. And it says, "And many of them that sleep in the dust of everlasting life shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever." God really values this prophetic message. And for those that get this out and turn many to righteousness, well, God says they're going to shine as the stars forever and ever. And that's a mind-blowing reward. Shine as the stars? What is that talking about? And other Bible prophecies talk about man being born into the God family, becoming God beings, having a face that shines like the stars, as it says here. God ties in the gospel message. He ties in mankind being brought into the God family, right into this passage of Bible prophecy. Ultimately, that's where all of this is leading, and that's where digging into Bible prophecy will really put our focus on the very real gospel and the good news that the Bible talks about. And that's different to the good news and what is called the gospel in churches in this world today. Digging into Bible prophecy points us to the very real hope for the world and a wonderful hope for every individual. Well, that is about all that we have time for. Thank you so much for joining us on today's Trumpet World. Hopefully this deep dive has been helpful in understanding this absolutely critical world event. You can get that book, The King of the South, that I just mentioned, on our website, thetrumpet.com. If you go to the literature tab there and then go down to showcase and click all, you should be able to find that. You can read it online. You can order your own free print copy. You just add it to the basket. I mean, we use the same, I guess, e-commerce terminology, but there will not be a fee. It won't be asking you to put in your credit card. You can just add it to your basket, order it. We ship it out anywhere in the world. There's no shipping cost. It's all free. There's no follow-up as well. Don't worry. We're not going to come knocking on your door, asking you to come to services with us or calling you up, asking you what you thought. Nothing like that. The only thing is if you get the Trumpet magazine, we will write you back in a few months or send you a little card saying this will be your last issue unless you send this card back to us. We want to make sure that you're still reading it, that you're still enjoying it. That's the only kind of follow-up you get from us. So we'd be very happy to send you that on our website, thetrumpet.com. If you have any questions, comments, any difficulty in getting this material, you can shoot us an email, trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. Thank you so much to Mihailo Zekic for joining me earlier, to George Haddad for engineering and production. We'll be back with our weekly review show on Friday. And until then, keep watching your world.